Dr. Peter Fenech is the internationally renowned expert on death-related phenomenon, or I guess I should say phenomena, because there are many of them. They're the experiences of the dying. There are the experiences of the grieving that are watching the dying, and those that are survived the death, and how they are coping with their loss and the visions they have. Are they hallucinations? Could it be that this near-death experience opens up, I don't know, some sort of portal? And how do we explain the consistency of these experiences? And what are the inconsistencies of these invisible visitors that come into the deathbed room of those that are passing on? What do we make of that, that the visitations are different in India, say, than they are in the United States? And then what about those grandfather clock stories we've heard so much about? Is it just a good legend, or are there verifiable versions of that story over the years that have been collected by doctors, much like Peter Fenech, people who are scientists at heart, but are also believers, or want to be, based on what they see? And how do they reconcile those two things? We'll talk about it all night long. The book is The Art of Dying, and you'll want to get in on this discussion. We'll go to the lines early because I know that so many people out there have had these experiences, the visions that have come in dreams, or maybe even in a waking state when somebody who love has died has come back to comfort you, maybe laid down next to you in bed. Other things that you would, if it were coming from anybody other than a doctor or a neuropsychiatrist, you might say, oh, come on. But you just might have to change that opinion based on what you'll hear next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I don't know where to start other than to say thank you, Dr. Peter Fenech. And I know your wife co-wrote this book with you, but I assume that most of the research on this comes from your own experience as a doctor and the people you're working with. Is that true?
Yeah, that's correct. Good evening. It's good morning here in London.
Yeah.
yes. Being a scientist, what I did was we did a number of research projects. We looked at palliative care teams. We went into hospices and talked to the carers and also into nursing home. And so a lot of our data came from the carers of the dying. And so we feel that our data is good because it relates directly to those who are in touch with the dying as they die.
Well, I love that about your book too, because you verify and you have names and places and dates, and it really it gives a level of credibility to the experience that's higher than, say, I heard this from somebody who saw it on the internet.
I'm pleased about that because being a scientist myself, I like to try and get the data correct and then follow the data. So we try to keep any belief out of the book and just look at what the dying say. If you want to know what dying is like, ask the dying. And
yeah.
So that's exactly what we did.
Let's just establish, too, what a neuropsychiatrist does. I think I know, but explain it then, just to make sure that we know exactly what your expertise is.
I've been trained in, first of all, psychiatry. I'm a medical doctor, and so I went through the standard medical training. But I've always been interested in consciousness and also in the wider mental states that people have. For example, mystical transcendent experiences, near-death experiences, and much more recently, what happens when we die. And because I'm a neuropsychiatrist, I'm trained also in neurology and brain function. And I've spent a lot of my life researching into consciousness and how the brain works. So I'm doubly qualified, if you like.
Yeah. Well, you're way overqualified to be on this show. I just want you to know. So, and I am the dumbest guy I know. So I will try to understand what you're talking about. If I run into a problem, I'll slow you down. But I think what I liked so much about when I read the book, and I read almost all of the book, is that you start with something that's anecdotal, but then you show a pattern in the anecdote. So let me ask you up front, at what point do anecdotes become data, where you collect something that becomes sort of establishes a theme?
I think anecdotes are the raw beginnings of science. In other words, you notice something, and then when you look at it, you find a pattern, and then you set up your hypotheses to try and explain the pattern. So in order to look at what happens as we die, we had to get a lot of accounts, and we were enormously lucky in that I went on a television show in the UK, and from that we got nearly 1,000 accounts, 700 from television and about 300 from a newspaper article. So we had a lot of accounts in which we could start looking at anecdotes and then finding the patterns.
And these were people who personally experienced something as opposed to a family legend.
That's absolutely right. If it was a family legend, it went into one of the chapters in the book which deal more with legends.
Right.
No, these were real experiences. You're sitting with your mom or your dad as they're dying, and then they describe exactly what happened.
Well, and so let's start there, because in a way we could kind of divide this up into three categories: the experiences of the dying before death, the experiences of the bereaved during the process before and after death, and then the experiences of a kind of witnesses and of other professionals who are kind of going along with the family and what they see in this. There may be even more than that, but that's kind of where I was going with this. So let's start with the first group, the people who are dying, and the consistency amongst those people who are passing in having these visitations, seeing visitors or having visions about something that's happening in the room that nobody else can see.
Yes, that I think is an excellent place to start, because it was in fact a British doctor, Lady Barrett, who was an obstetrician, and she was at the birth of a woman, and unfortunately the woman was dying from a hemorrhage, although the child was all right, and as she died she began to see visions. And what she said is she looked eagerly towards a part of the room, and the radiant smile illuminating her whole countenance. "Oh, lovely, lovely," she said. When asked what it was she saw, she replied, "Lovely brightness, wonderful beings." A moment later, she exclaimed, "Why, it's Father. Oh, he's so glad I'm coming. He's so glad. It would be perfect if only my husband could come too." And then the important point of her experience was the patient then cried out, "Oh, he's so near. He has Vida with him. Vida is with him." Now, that was a remarkable thing, because Vida was in fact her sister, and she didn't know that her sister had died. And in fact, the vision was of both her father and her sister. The sister had recently died, and that started Sir William Barrett on his search for more of these visions. And that was really what started it in this country, because he then published a book on it.
Right.
Now the visions are very clear, and from our accounts, we find that they occur usually in the last 2 weeks of life. The person will report that a parent, dead parent, or a dead brother or sister, very occasionally a dead friend, will come to talk to them. The dying are very pleased with this, and they greet the people. The visitor will probably just make one or two appearances to begin with, and then they come closer and closer as dying approaches. And usually before you die, in the days before you die, they'll actually sit on your bed. And many people die holding their hands out or trying to get out of bed to go with their visitors. So their visitors are very real to them.
You know, I like and there seemed to be a little bit of a separation between people that were dying and became fixated on something in the room, and they didn't articulate what it was, but it seemed like a point of light or something that was catching their eye up, say, right around the top of the wall or in the ceiling, and they start being drawn to it, and they might even wordlessly be looking at something, and then they pass on. And then there are those that actually are having conversations with folks in the room. And in some cases, I like that one story about the person, maybe you can tell it better than this, who was telling the visitor in the room, no, I don't want to go yet, because they were still expecting their son to show up.
Isn't that a lovely story? Yes. when one has looked at a lot of these accounts, they do have a pattern to them. And that is that, first of all, you're glad to see the person who comes. Then you can, if you are strong enough, you can talk to them. I suspect many people do talk to them, but because they're too weak, we don't know that. But the ones that we do know about, they talk to them, and they can negotiate with them. They can say, how are you? And the person who's come, the visitor, will say, I'll be back to you on Tuesday. And the visitor often sets the time of death for them. And if they say they'll be back on Tuesday, then usually the dying person on Tuesday will see them and go with them. So some people, as you mentioned, refuse to go. What they do is they say, please, don't come back on Tuesday because I'm not ready to go. And as you mentioned, one of our accounts, this was a son who they were waiting for who's coming from Australia. But we've had a number of accounts of very important things that the dying want to do. And it's usually related to the family. And you can negotiate a little bit with them. But occasionally, people say, I'm not ready to go. I don't want to go. Go away. But I'm afraid they usually go anyway.
You know, it made me think, and it kind of reminded me of the movie Ghost, which illustrates that very same thing in the peaceful, happy way of somebody who's in the process of dying. And then they look up, and then what starts is a beam of light, and then it turns into sort of a wider tunnel of light, and then faces are apparent of people who love that person, who are there to kind of guide them into the afterworld. But then in the other part of Ghost, the movie, there was this, you know, the belief that if one did not live their life well, that demons would come to them and their last moments of consciousness would be torturous. And it made me wonder whether there's ever any of those examples where somebody who is saying, no, I don't want to go, I don't want to go, and they're describing something that is not a heavenly experience but a hellish one.
Do you know, in all the accounts we had, we didn't have any hellish experiences. The most we had was people not wanting to go, but they were really very few, and they're very few for the reason that you mentioned. We have some wonderful accounts of what the place is like to which they're going, and we have accounts of believers and non-believers. So this is not a question of belief. It seems to be much more a question of fact, and it's something like this. The dying will look up, and sometimes they'll see a light, but sometimes they seem to be able to move into a different reality, and it's composed of love, compassion, and joy. Light is very prominent in it, and it's not too dissimilar to the sort of reality that those in near-death experiences go into. Then the dying are enormously reassured by this. We have some wonderful accounts of people who have seen this lovely, compassionate light as they're dying and talked to their relatives and said, listen, don't be afraid of dying. It's very comforting, and I've seen this light, and I know everything's going to be okay. Now, that's a strange thing to say when you're dying, everything's going to be okay. But it's what they say, and they say something else too, and this is a general pattern. The dying never refer to themselves as dying in this last week once the visitors have come. Their whole language changes, and they always talk about going on a journey. Everything becomes a journey. Everything is a movement towards something which is going to happen.
Hmm.
When my aunt comes, I will go with her. When grandfather comes and I fall, I'll go with him. Do you see? So the whole language changes, and there's enormous expectation.
I want to amplify something you just said there, though, because you talked about the believers and non-believers.
Yeah.
Can you pull that apart a little bit more and talk about how what your evidence was of people who were not believers in life after death experienced the same thing as people who had always expected that there would be somebody there to greet them to the next experience?
Yes. We had we have one or two examples like this, and one which stands out in my mind is there was a mother and son, and the son believed that there was life after death, and the mother was firmly against it. She knew that death was the final end. Now, the mother's dying, and the son is at the bedside, and first of all, the mother gets a visit from her dead husband, which unsettles her somewhat. And then as she starts to die, she sees this light and this area of compassion and love, and she turns to her son and says, "You were right," and then she dies. And that, I think, is a wonderful example of the difference between expectation and belief and the actual experience of dying.
And that, I think that's a good lead into the expectation that some Christians would have, for example, that Jesus would be there for them, or that there would be a religious figure, a saintly, a well-known religious figure to greet them. But that isn't usually the case, right? I mean, they don't. The appearance of Jesus is not that prominent amongst Christians.
In our sample, and remember, our sample comes from the UK, so most of the people are either Church of England or Catholic in our sample. And many of them don't have very strong beliefs.
Right.
But what we found was that only 3% of our sample saw angels. So angels were really very rare, and we had no reports of religious figures at all. And so what we do now is we come on to this whole question of what culture does. Does culture change the visitors that come for you?
Well,
I think the answer let's
hang that up right there, because then we'll come right back to that. That's a great place to stop with that question. How does culture influence the invisible visitors that form a pattern in this research for the book, The Art of Dying? Dr. Peter Fenech, this is just going to be a terrific time tonight. I can hear it already. There's so many of you who are going to try and get through, and I'll try to open up the phones early for you. The Art of Dying, we'll get into that then. What about India? What about America? How does it change depending on where the person is dying? And then we'll get into what happens to the bereaved in those dreamlike visitations that happen after the person passes. And then later on, what is a good death? Dr. Peter Fenech on the way on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Peter Fenech was just talking about culture, and so let's pick up there. As you studied not just your own research, but then also sort of collated it with other research done around the world, what did you find out about the visions that people were having on their deathbed?
what we found out was the following, that in our culture, the 25% of people have their mothers or their fathers come to collect them. The visions have a very specific meaning. They come to collect. They take away visions. And this message is true in every culture. So the visions are there for the purpose of taking the person on. Now, we've spoken to John Lerma from your country, and I think he's been on Coast to Coast as well. And he finds many more angels and spiritual beings than we do in the UK. And it may be because he's in the south of North America, in Houston. Now, there was a study done by Osis and Haraldson, and they looked at an Indian population and a U.S. population. This was done a long time ago in the 70s. And they found that in the Indian population, then the messenger of the god of death was very commonly the person who came to pick you up. And they also saw more religious figures. Now, we have spoken, we've got a number of anecdotal accounts from other cultures, but there haven't been any proper studies done. So we're looking forward to studies being done in Japan, Asia, and so on, to see if we can see the absolute influence of culture on it. But I think the bottom line of this is that the person who comes, comes to take you, comes to carry you on with your journey. And in fact, the form that he takes is to some extent influenced by culture, but not always.
Mm. And so it would be noteworthy if, for example, people who were non-Christians, say, in India, saw Jesus a lot, or if people who were in Texas saw, for example, Buddha, or saw some other, religious figure. So, but that doesn't tend to be the case. There's very little cross-pollinization going on.
Very little.
Right.
And I think what happens is that as the cultures become more secular, then there's a much stronger influence of family members who come to pick you up. I think what we feel is that the person who comes to collect you is somebody that you personally are happy with and comfortable with.
Well, and, no, please go ahead. I didn't mean to stop you.
And that because they always come with a message of hope for you, it's important that you respect the messenger who's going to take you.
I wonder whether there could be some, I don't know if this is the proper word for it, but contamination in the data on that, in that the perception that many people have is that their guardian angel is a former family member. And so they might become one in the same. To see an angel is to see dad or mom or an uncle or a grandparent.
Yes, I think that that you can argue that. Of course, our data doesn't really help with that particular point. What it does help with, though, is this question of expectation. If you have a very strong expectation, it doesn't mean that person will come. For example, we had a nice account of the woman who was dying, and she saw an angel who came to her, and she said, "This is not what I was expecting." And so you get the other side of it. But she obviously felt quite happy with the angel.
No, it's so fascinating.
It's a difficult one, but I don't think it's expectation. But there is a cultural element to it.
I love the story that. That you pass on about the woman, I believe it was, who was in bed, and with every passing day, the visitors, the invisible visitors in the room with whom she was speaking, got closer and closer and closer to the bed.
That's absolutely fascinating, and this is one of the characteristics of these deathbed visitors. My own feeling on this is that it's what you're comfortable with. They start outside the hospice and people see them through the windows. Then they come closer and they come into the room. And then usually they are really very comforting and close to you at the time that you actually die and are sitting on the bed. But I think that if we start to understand and learn about death and know what is likely to happen, we can do many, in many ways, enhance this process. If we start looking forward to the visitor who comes, hope that they will come closer to us earlier on, I think probably that we will be able to, in some way, change the, what happens with the visitor when they come. And I think they'll probably come earlier.
So that's just part of the experience of the person that is dying. Talk about the research that you did to try to establish whether some of these things are just coincidences or hallucinations.
Okay. Let's start, first of all, with are the deathbed visitors, deathbed visions, are they hallucinations? Well, a hallucination is defined as an experience which is seen by the person who has it, but no one else. Now, we do have accounts, they're rare, but we do have accounts of carers of the dying, professional carers of the dying, seeing the same hallucination or the same apparition that the person who's dying does.
That's just amazing.
And we also have many accounts from children. Children seem to see these much more than adults do. So they are seen by other people, rarely, but this would mean that, that they are no longer hallucinations. The other point, everybody says, well, of course, it's morphine, isn't it? It's the drugs and painkillers that they're given. Now, the answer to that is it doesn't seem like that, because those who work with the dying say that they can tell very easily what a hallucination is when it's drug-induced, and they're quite different. They don't carry this huge emotional impact. They're more irritating. You see little bugs climbing up the wall. You see things on the carpet. They're very different. So then the next question is, if it's not drugs, could it be because these people are confused due to the actual dying process itself? Remember, all your organs are going down as you come close to death. So perhaps it's just a confusional state. The answer to that is no, it's not, because a number of people remain lucid and clear in their consciousness right up to the moment of death. And those are the people who give us the best account of these phenomena. So it occurs in clear consciousness. So we can't argue for a confusional state. So what is it? And I think our view is very clear, and that is that it is actually part of the death process itself. It seems to be, if you like, hardwired into us that we will be collected by somebody.
And yet, since you brought up the other people sharing the same experience, people who are sitting on the bed, maybe that's a good transition into people who are left behind, the grieving. They often pick up in the visitation process, too. And so is that hardwired where they lose a loved one and yet they are visited by that person? And what's the percentage of cases where somebody receives a visit?
Okay, let's talk about that. The percentage we don't have, the absolute percentage we don't know. We know they're common. So what we're going to deal with now are what we call death phenomena, associated death phenomena. There's a whole range of these, and they're really enormously exciting and interesting and challenging for us as well. The first one of these is deathbed coincidences. Then the next one are, you mentioned clocks, I think, in one of your leaders.
Yes, yeah, I did.
Things like clocks, shapes leaving the body, mists, etc. Light is another one that we need to talk about. And then strange animal behavior. But let's start with deathbed coincidences. Now, these are fascinating. They are when, at the time of death, somebody, and this is driven by the person who's dying, it's either a close relative to them or it's a friend of theirs, they appear to that person at a distance. In other words, This person may be at their home. They may be in a different country. For example, you could be dying in the UK, and you could appear at the moment of death to somebody in Australia. Do you see? It's as if the dying make a visit. Now, what we found out from our data is that it depends on the mental state of the person who receives the visit as to the form and the nature that the visit will take. So let's take those people who are awake at the time that you die. Well, if you're awake, then you get this overpowering feeling that something terrible has happened to your friend, that they're in trouble, that or your relative, that you have to contact them. Some people describe it as a push. Other people describe it as a sort of light-like feeling, a blue light we had in one occasion. But it's definitely a compulsion. So let me give you an example. One person, he hadn't seen his dad for many years because they didn't get on very well together. And he was walking to work, and he suddenly had this compulsion to go home, very strong, so strong that he went to the train station, got on, went to his home to find out when he got there that his dad had just died. And so this compulsion will change your behavior. These are very strong things. They're not just, oh, gosh, I wonder what happened to Aunt May. It's not like that. You know Aunt May is in terrible trouble. Another example is somebody who had to ring her dad. She was in Italy. The dad was in America. She rang home to find out that her dad had just died, having fallen down the cellar steps. So these deathbed coincidences are very clear. So that's when you are awake. When you're asleep, they have a quite different quality to them. Then they are narrative. By that, I mean they tell a story. And also, you get dreamlike accounts. And there's some relationship between what happens to the dying person and to you. So here's a lovely story. There was a woman who was asleep in bed. And she, first of all, was woken up by her mother who had died. So her mother appeared to her, her dead mother appeared to her in a dream, and the woman felt that the dead mother had something important to say, so she instantly became awake. Now, I'm not sure whether she was awake or not. Because of the quality of the next bit of the story, I think she probably wasn't. But she then became aware that her son had come, and he was dripping wet in the dream. And as the son came towards her, he slowly transformed and became surrounded by the light. And you know the light carries with it love and compassion. And he said to his mother, "I'm okay now. Please don't worry. It's all okay." And then he slowly faded. And she sat up in bed and told her husband immediately. And she knew that something awful had happened to her son, but she didn't know what. And the next morning, when she was able to get in contact with her son's friends, they told her that her son had been drowned in a drowning accident at about the time that she got her vision, her dream. And so that is a typical one that happens when you're asleep. And the other thing we find is that there is no limitation in space. They can cross continents. We got a lovely one of a person whose grandfather died, and he was a submariner. And in fact, he was deep down in the Atlantic when he got his deathbed coincidence. So they're really interesting phenomena.
And is there any way to explain that scientifically?
None.
Yeah.
Absolutely none. And I say none because our science argues that mind and brain are the same. Now, I don't think that's right if you look at the data, because many people on your show, I'm sure, will have discussed telepathy.
Right.
And the evidence for telepathy is very good. Now, this shows a linking of minds. Now, if you accept that there is a linking of minds, then it's not surprising that at the moment of death, you should there should be a linking of minds between people who feel very strongly for each other. Jung was looked at.
Carl Jung?
Carl Jung, yes, the psychiatrist and analyst, looked at these sorts of experiences, and his argument was that when an archetype is activated, this is the archetype of death, it's the view that is held by a whole population of people. When the archetype of death is activated, then there is a fracturing of space-time. Now, I don't know what that means, but he was trying to say that that death is a very, very special time, and very, very special things occur. And I'll tell you more about what actually happens at the time of death when we get on to it. So the argument is it's going to be in the same realm as telepathy, and this requires extended mind, which is not within mainstream science, although the evidence for it, I feel, is quite good.
Well, and you talk about evidence, and I think that evidence exists, hard evidence exists, somewhere in those clock stories, because that's something physical that has changed as a result of what is perceived, I think, as a metaphysical process. And so you have tell the story about the woman with the clock that was in her garage, and the one that was the 10 minutes to 11 story.
Oh, yes. That was a lovely one. The woman had this clock in her garage, and she got it out, and it was her mother's clock, and she set it going, and when her mother died, it stopped absolutely at the time of her mother's death.
She just wound it that morning. I mean, she knew it wasn't because it had run out, and she didn't know that her mother was about to die. So when she got the call that her mother had died, it was at the same time the clock had stopped. And I thought this was important. The clock had never stopped after that. I mean, she had kept using that clock for years, and it never stopped again.
Yes, and this is one of the interesting things about these stories. You know, in America, you have grandfather clocks.
Right.
These long, tall clocks.
Right.
Well, these used to be called long case clocks until an American songwriter came and stayed at a pub in England at a place called Piercebridge, and there was this story that he was told about the clock. You can still see it. It's in Yorkshire.
Well, here's what I'm gonna have you stop again right there, because we're coming up to the top of the hour, and I want you to start right there then. Next hour, because I think that's really, and I want you to have the time to tell it right, the story of how that long clock became what we know as a grandfather clock, and then let's get into the process of death too in this next hour, and we'll also open up the calls, and we'll talk about a good death with Dr. Peter Fenech, who's been studying the art of dying. What is that process? And more stories of these extraordinary phenomena. We'll get a little bit more into what happens after death to the bereaved as well, and start taking your calls coming up. It's just an amazing book. He's a great guest. I know you're going to love reading this. And on every page, you're going to say, I told you so, I told you so. It's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking about the book, The Art of Dying. Later this hour, we will start taking calls for you to get in with Dr. Peter Fenech with the stories of things that have actually happened to you. Not stories as far as you're concerned, but experiences. And there is a difference here. In fact, this is the difference between what somebody like Dr. Fenech is doing, applied science, and what other people might do, which are just ghost stories. So we'll share that with you coming up this hour. Also, we'll get to the discussion of the grandfather clock. How did it get to be called the grandfather clock? You may not know that whole story. And what it tells us about the art of dying. And then what is a good death next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Okay, Dr. Peter Fenech was just getting into the grandfather clock story when our clock rudely interrupted him. So Because I think this is really interesting, and I didn't know that this came was all linked to an American songwriter.
Yep. A man called Henry Clay Work. And it was the song was written in 1876. And Henry Clay Work was staying at a pub in England. And I'll just read you out the lines of the song. My grandfather clock was too large for the south, so it stood 90 years on the floor. It was taller by half than the old man himself, though it weighed not a penny weight more. It was bought on the morn of the day that he was born and was always his treasure and pride. It stopped short, never to go again, when the old man died. And that's where we get the name grandfather clock from. Before that, it was long case clocks. But the story's slightly more interesting than that because there were two brothers there. When the first brother died, the clock went slow and they couldn't time it properly. And then when the old man died, it stopped dead, never to go again.
And this was the story of a clock, and they never got it to work again. And this American songwriter just happened to be passing through when someone told him about this?
That's absolutely right. He stayed there and he heard the story, and then he went back to America and wrote the song. And if you go to Pierce Bridge today, you can still see the clock. It's a bit battered, but it's still there.
Well, it's so interesting. And, of course, in America, they're always called grandfather clocks, and they became quite the rage after that.
Yeah, it was all from him. Yeah. But we were interested, is it only mechanical clocks which stop, or do the modern electric watches stop, or do the modern electric clocks stop? And the answer to that is we have stories of all sorts of clocks stopping. There's a lovely one. A nephew went around to tell his uncle that his brother had died. And when he went into the house, his uncle was there, but not really surprised. And when the nephew asked him why he wasn't surprised to hear of his brother's death, he said, and pointed to all the clocks. The clock on the mantelpiece stopped at 3:15 a.m. There was a blinking LED clock, which had 3:15 on it. His watch had stopped at 3:15. All the clocks had stopped at 3:15. It's an amazing story.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of this, is that then you also think about this as a scientist. Is there any way to explain that as a scientist?
No, you have to again say that there is an interconnectedness between people and what they and the things that they own, or that in some way that they can affect what other people who they're attached to own. So it seems to spread out just from the person himself to what they own, and hence the clock stopping like that. It's a very meaningful thing, obviously, to have your clock stop
right
at the time that your brother dies.
So that would bring us to kind of a discussion of the release of energy or something at the time of death.
Yes, and there we have some fascinating phenomena. The first one that I think is, to me, is important is light surrounding the body. At the time of death, if people enter the light, in other words, if the light shines on them, then it's always composed of compassion, love, and joy. So there's this feeling of joy and love and sometimes light at the moment of death. The next thing is that people see shapes leaving the body, and these have a very specific form. It's not what we think of as sort of ghosts, but it is what we think of in terms of mists. And so people describe the moment of death, a haze-like shimmering as something seems to leave. Other people describe it as smoke. Other people describe it as sparks. And then, of course, other people as light. And if you take those phenomena that I've said, they're very, very close to those that are described by the Dalai Lama in the Tibetan way of thinking of death. And it seems as if there is a cross correspondence between what people of the dying see and what people who are watching the dying, that is, and what the Tibetans say. And the way that I think of this is that as not everybody sees them who's surrounding the body at the moment of death, I think possibly that it may be a sort of sharing of what is going on within the dying person at the time of death. It's difficult to formulate it, but if you formulate it that way, then you can see how the Dalai Lama's account and what we see in our culture are very similar.
Well, okay, but as a scientist, as a neuropsychologist, is there a metabolic process at the moment of death that might account for this release of energy or this mist or anything else that would tie those, the physical that we can measure, with the metaphysical that we experience?
I think this is a difficult one because if one is talking about the moment of death, or around the moment of death, there are, of course, a whole lot of energetic processes which start to run down. As soon as the heart stops and respiration stops, then in 11 seconds, brain function stops. And with that, of course, you lose all your life support systems, and the body starts to move towards death, which it will achieve, or it will be irreversible, in about 5 minutes. Completely irreversible. And you then get a whole set of biochemical processes, those that maintain the cell walls, those that maintain the actual structures within the cell, that they all will start to run down. So that there is a huge energy change within the body. Now, whether you can argue that some of these are related to that or not, I don't know. My own feeling is that this is probably more psychological than it is physiological, but we don't know yet. We need more evidence.
How would you relate that which you've been studying and the thing you just described right there with the accounts of children, for example, who drowned underneath the ice in under frozen conditions and are brought back, you know, an hour afterward or 20, 25, 30 minutes after being pronounced dead because the body was so cold that somehow life was preserved even though the heart itself had stopped?
I think this one is pretty well understood now, and that is that the metabolic requirements of the brain and the tissues decrease as you cool them. And this is why when you're doing either brain surgery or heart surgery, you cool the body so as to reduce the amount of oxygen that you need to provide to the tissues to keep them alive. So if you are under the ice, then you're cooled right down to almost freezing. The metabolic needs of the body are very much lower. So you can survive for long periods and be resuscitated again.
Well, what about what the person experienced in that time that they were then frozen in that state?
Well, you do get a number of people who have near-death experiences, and when they recover from drownings like that, they do have near-death experiences. And I think it's just worth talking about this because we're now coming on to the next question. We talked a little bit about all the phenomena that occur at the time of death, but do remind me to tell you about other strange things that happen as you die.
Yeah, about animals and stuff.
Yeah,
too.
Okay. Right. So we'll come on to that. But let's just deal now with what actually happens when your heart stops, your respiration stops, and you actually start the dying process and will never come back again. Well, we have one model for that we're looking at. And that is what happens in cardiac arrest. In other words, here you get the three cardinal signs of death, which is no respiration, no pulse, and all the brain stem and life support reflexes are down. Now, in this state, if you study it, 10% of people will have near-death experiences. Now, the near-death experiences are not totally different from those that other people have reported before. There have been four studies on this, and ours was, in fact, the first one with my co-worker was Sam Parnia, and he's been in the news recently with an extended study of this. And what we found was that these people whose brains were not functioning, and the heart and respiration weren't functioning, obviously, had an out-of-body experience where they saw the resuscitation process, and then they had a normal near-death experience. And so we argue that if one can be absolutely certain that these did happen at that time, in other words, when you had no heart, etc., then this is probably a good model for the beginnings of the death process itself. And this, to some extent, goes in with what the dying say they're going towards, which is a wonderful area with compassion, love, and light. And that's just what people with near-death experiences say. So I think probably you needn't be too afraid when you're going to die.
Does that bring us naturally to a discussion of what is a good death?
Yep. Yes, it's slightly moves it. Can I just tell you about animals? Because I know we'll forget them.
Well, if I promised you we won't forget them, because I know we're going to hear that from people who are calling in, which is
okay.
I'm quite certain what we'll hear is a variety of the stories that you've already collected, but in first person form coming up on the phones. But I made a big note for myself because I'm fascinated by the dog thing too. But
okay.
Let's talk about it, because I thought there was such an interesting diversion in your book into a good death.
A good death is really what this book is about. It's telling us that there is a process to dying. If you listen to a scientist, what they say is that death is just a switching off. It's not really of any interest to us. Doctors consider it a failure, and so if you're going to die, they will either strive beyond all reasonable ways to keep you alive, and you may have a horrid death then in an intensive care unit. A good death is when you can actually choose your death, choose what you want. So the first thing then is you must obviously read the book and learn what's likely to happen so that you don't go to death unprepared. And then the death process starts. You go to a hospice, and the first parts of the death process are healing. As one of our people said, death is not a great experience, but it is a healing experience. The first part of a good death is that you want to get all your relationships right. If you've been fighting with your son, then the atmosphere in the room where you're dying is conducive to the mending of rifts. So the first part of a good death then is the healing of rifts, the settling and visiting those parts of your life that you're not happy or weren't happy with, and coming to terms with them. Then the next part is to be surrounded by people who you love. And the idea of dying again in an intensive care unit alone is really a horrid thought when you can be surrounded by those who you love. Of course, not all of us can do that.
Right.
But in this country, we're getting much closer to it. And if you die of cancer, now you can, because Macmillan nurses come to your home and help support you and look after you at home as you die. So that is wonderful. And then once your relationships have been sorted out and you've got your life in order, then you will go into the final week of death, and then you'll get your visitors who come and pick you up. So that, I think, is a good death.
I think that is, in chaplaincy, when I was doing a rotation as a hospital chaplain, I learned this particular exchange, which we would often teach to siblings of somebody who was passing on, especially if there were hard feelings between the generations, and we would always say that you should offer to the dying your forgiveness and ask for their forgiveness for anything that you did that disappointed them. Even if it's, you know, even if it's disproportionately, it was an abusive father or somebody, if you want to bury the hatchet with the dad, then you say, you know, I just want to let you know, I forgive you for anything you did, and I hope you forgive me too. And it sets the table for the other person who may not be inclined to ask for forgiveness to take that and to work more in that area. And it really works. It's very effective, I think. Is that your experience?
I absolutely agree. And that is so wise. And that's the most wonderful thing that you said there, because this, after all, is what dying is about. It is, in fact, forgiveness. It is reconciliation. Yeah. It is coming to terms, and that's exactly what you should do. I think the other thing that one has to remember, that although it's nice to be surrounded by the family, a lot of people choose to die alone, and this is a positive choice. And if only we could discuss these things. You see, what we have done in our culture is push death way, way away. In fact, if you're born, you die, and so it's all part of the cycle. And I think what we need to do is to understand it. We need to ask the dying person, possibly before they get that close, do you want to die alone? Do you want us to be here when you die?
Right.
Because there is a moment when the dying person can voluntarily decide to hold on to life or to let go. And some people want to die alone. They actually don't want to die in front of the family. So they always choose the moment when the family are out of the room just to let go and die. Well, so you have some control at the last moment.
And so that's a good death. Let's talk a little bit about a bad death, at least in one sense, maybe some under circumstances of violence or fear. And do we know as much about, like, say, battlefield visions? Or people who are, you know, caught in an accident. Did you collect any stories from people who were not at peace or in hospice at the time?
Yes, we did. The model that we have for the violent death ones, the car accidents, the sudden death ones, are the cardiac arrest model, because there the heart suddenly stops. And then they go through the near-death experience, or 10% of them do, which I've described. So we think that to some extent covers the sudden death. But the other half of your question is a really interesting one. Do some people have horrid deaths? Do they go through a spiritual agony before they die? And this is well recognized by care workers, that some people do become very restless, and it's called terminal restlessness. Now, the usual way to deal with terminal restlessness is to sedate people more, and maybe that's fine. But there is a feeling now that terminal restlessness is related to spiritual anxiety, spiritual difficulties. In other words, because you haven't come to terms with your life, with the people around you, then you are really very disturbed. And again, it's the discussion in the last week or few weeks of life that make this terminal restlessness much less likely to occur. Mm. So again, it's an understanding of death and the death process.
The Art of Dying, Dr. Peter Fenech is our guest. He's the co-author of the book along with his wife, and we will open up the phones and start taking calls. And don't worry, in big letters on my page right here, it's written Animal Stories. We'll get to that coming up next. And other seemingly random phenomenon on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So let's just hang on to where we are with those animal stories. But first, let's go east of the Rockies, where Lisa was the first one to get through in Florida on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Peter Fenech. Lisa?
Hi, Ian. I have had these circumstances happen to me. Back in the year 1996 and before then, I do a lot of genealogy. And I've often had people tell me that usually their ancestor would pass after reporting that they had seen a family member or like a grandparent or whatever. And in about July of 96, I started to feel that something was wrong with my grandmother, that she might pass soon, just from the way that I kept having this feeling. And every night I would just dread leaving her because I just didn't want to stand the thought of her passing and nobody being there with her. And one night I had taken her dinner and she told me, she said, you know, she said, your grandpa appeared in my living room last night. And I said, he did. And she said, yeah. And I said, well, what did he tell you? And she said, he said, honey, it's time to come home. And I slipped because I started crying and I was really upset because I knew what she was telling me. And the months passed on. It got to be October of 96. And she called me one morning telling me she was feeling bad. And I took her to the hospital, and things seemed to be fine, and they were going to perform some routine tests. I had gone to take my son home, and I got a frantic phone call from my sister telling me something was wrong with my grandmother, and she put the phone up to my grandmother's ear long enough to tell me that she loved me. And by the time I made it to the hospital, she was gone. And afterwards, I got to view her body. I got to be alone with her. And I have never had an experience like I felt, because even though I could see her body, I felt her presence. Just like, you know, you feel somebody walk up behind you or near you. I felt her presence near me, and I felt comforted. Hmm. And the months after that, I wasn't doing too well with the grief. And I had been laying in bed and I was crying. You know, I was kind of like halfway asleep, halfway awake. And I heard her voice say to me, well, now I'm all right. And I sat up and I looked around and I thought, did I dream this? I just couldn't believe what I had heard. And I know that I heard it. And since that time, I have had several dreams with her where I have dreamed that I've actually carried on a conversation with her.
Well, hold on a second here. Let's let Dr. Peter Fenech jump in. And thank you for your candor. And I can hear your grief and your emotion in that. But, Peter, this is right. This is like cuts across three chapters of your book, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. The Dalai Lama says that you know about 2 years before you're going to die. So most of us get intimations of our death. Hmm. And also in we've had accounts rather like Lisa's of the grandparents usually visiting, dead grandparents visiting the living person and saying, and either just appearing or they intimate that it's time for the other person to go. So that fits in very much with the other stories that we've heard. And usually it doesn't seem to have been so much in Lisa's case, but usually they sometimes say that it's okay because where they're going, that there isn't, it's fine and they're okay. And so this is enormous help with the actual grieving process itself. Now, we didn't study the after-death communication side, but if you're studying the death and what occurs around it, you do get stories of the after-death. And what Lisa is saying is very common. There is certainly a sense in the room where somebody has died, and we had this reported often. So, yes, there is a sense of the person still being present in the room after they've died. And after a little while, and most people recognize that this weakens. But then later on, people do have experiences of the dying.
I'm reminded of the story of the woman who was kept feeling her mother lying in her bed with her.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And there are a number of studies on this, but the ones we had, that was a very nice one, that the mother... the daughter felt that her mother would sometimes come and lie beside her in her bed, enormously reassuring, enormously comforting. And so that does occur.
Yeah, you know, I should mention, it's a family story. It didn't happen to me, but my cousin told me this story about when my uncle had died, and he had been a regular kind of neighborhood helper for the elderly. He was older himself, but there were many people who were older than he was, and he would shovel the walks of people who were too old to get out and do that when it snowed. And it had been, I guess, in the winter when my uncle had passed, and this story was told to me directly that the family called a woman down the street who enjoyed a relationship with my uncle. He had come over frequently, and he had shoveled her walk, and it had snowed. And they called her to say, well, just, you know, Dad died. And she said, oh, that's so weird. He was just standing out on the sidewalk waving to me just within the last hour. And they said, well, that's impossible. He was in the hospital. And they said, no, he was just out there on the sidewalk waving to me. And I thought, okay, that's so freaky. And I think I got the story right, but it resonated completely with the stories in The Art of Dying.
Yes. And again, the appearance of people after death is well recorded. And certainly some of the stories we have support that. Ian, I was just wondering, could I give an email address to you for people who have stories? We probably won't be able to reply to them all because I hope there'll be a lot of them.
There'll be a lot more than you think there will be.
Then we definitely won't reply to them all. It's Peter_Fenwick, FENWICK. So it's Peter_Fenwick, FENWICK, at BT Internet, all one word, btinternet.com. So Peter_Fenwick at btinternet.com. And if Ian is correct, I'm sorry, we won't be able to reply at all, but we'd love your story.
Well, I'll sort that out a little bit more just by saying spell Fenwick like you would be spelling Fenwick in this country, where commonly that's how we would pronounce that last
name.
Yeah,
that's right.
So spell it like Fenwick. So Peter_Fenwick. And I guess in this country we would say Evelyn in Washington. They would say Evelyn in England. Evelyn?
Yes.
You have a story for Dr. Peter Fenwick.
Oh, yes, I do. My mom, first of all, thank you for having me. My mom passed away 10 months ago, and I had an amazing experience, and almost everything that you're saying is just ringing a bell. And when it happened, I was so euphoric I was so happy because I finally saw proof. I had a watch on that I had gotten, and my boyfriend had given it to me. It was brand new. And I'd had it on for a couple of days, and the watch had actually stopped the day before my mom passed. But I didn't take it off because I was so distraught and I didn't take a shower. Everything was horrible. You know, it was just a horrible time. And so I didn't take it off, and it is stopped the day before, 24 hours before, the exact time of her death the next day. I was the only one with her when she passed. And I was singing to her some Christmas songs. This was last November. She loved Christy Lane Christmas songs. And so I was singing, rubbing her forehead. And I was there for about 45 minutes. And in the timing, I never was there at that time of day. I'd always go and spend all the overnights with her and let all the whole crowd go during the day. And I felt she didn't want all those people there. She liked them there. She wanted to say goodbye to them, but it was just too much commotion. I have four older brothers and all of them and their families, and it was just it was too much commotion, and I wouldn't go there when everyone was there because I took care of my mom the last couple of years.
Right.
And her and I were very close, and she knew that I probably had to be there when she died. So she timed it as well. But anyway, back to right before she passed.
Right.
I was singing to her some Christy Lane songs, and she had been pretty much unconscious for days, and it had made no response, or if she did make a response, it was of trouble, not too much trouble, but like if someone was trying to move her, the pain that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
She passed from cancer. The last half an hour, she kept opening her eyes, and they were like she was waking up from just a half an hour nice restful sleep, just so easily opened and opened wide open. And I thought, oh my God, maybe she's getting well on me. I don't know. I mean, this was so weird because my mom had not done that.
Sure.
Not only did she do that, she kept twinkling her nose, like twitching it, like Bewitched, those old reruns.
Right.
You know, just like somebody was tickling her, saying, it's time, it's time. But, you know, of course, I didn't see anything and I
sure.
didn't hear anything. So I was singing with her these songs, and I had the jukebox going, or my little disc player going, and I'm singing with right along with Christy Lane, and again she twinkled her nose for the last time, and she opened her eyes just as beautiful. I mean, I'm just so relaxed for the last time, and that tape deck just slammed right off. I mean, right in the middle of the song.
It just stopped.
I was singing with her the 10th song on it, which was it's a beautiful, cute little song. It's that Shake Me, I Rattle,
right,
and
right,
Take
right.
Me
but,
Home and Love
but,
Me.
But it just stopped.
And it was not like it just kind of just went off. It was like something slammed it off. And it startled me. And right then, I thought, oh, my God, I know my mom's leaving. She's leaving. Take their hand, Mom. Take their hand. It's okay to go. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't see any light. I didn't see anything that weird, but that thing just slammed right up, and I knew she was leaving. I just felt it. So I stood there for a second, and I didn't know. I was too freaked out. I mean, I was like, oh, my God, it worked, because I knew that my mom needed to go. And
sure.
Because she'd been in there for days. I mean, she'd been off all of her.
Right. So that's amazing, and thank you. And that fits right in with kind of the clock stopping stories
you
heard earlier.
Then I looked at my watch to see the time of death. I thought, I can't look at this watch. It stopped yesterday. And I looked at the watch on the clock on the wall, because I was alone with her in a nursing the end of life room. And it said 12:30. I said, wait a minute, that's just what my watch said. And I looked at my watch, and it stopped at the exact time of death, 12:29. So I ran down the hall. I got the nurses. They came back, because I really didn't know if she died. I didn't have a heart monitor. She was on, nothing went deep or nothing like that.
Right.
Ran down the hall, got the nurses. They came back and said, yes, she has passed. And then I still didn't even connect the watch with her until a while later. I thought, with the clock on the wall,
right.
And I looked at my watch, and I'm like, my God, my watch has been stopped 24 hours exactly. I mean, if you look at the mathematical statistics on 1 minute every 24 hours, and
exactly.
It's stopping a brand new watch the day before, but I never took it off because of all the commotion and all how distraught
I was. Evelyn, I appreciate you sharing that. It's almost like a something for your sequel to this book, Dr. Peter Fenwick.
Yeah. Evelyn, that was a lovely story. Did the watch go again afterwards?
Did the watch get going again, Evelyn?
What's that?
Did the watch get going again?
No, it's never. Oh, my gosh, no. I would die if it ever started. No, I keep that in a beautiful case in my living room.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that.
I think there's some lovely things about that. One thing I want to highlight, and that is that the dying do become very sensitive. And that's Evelyn's point about not having many people visit just towards the end is absolutely right. And if you are visiting, just very gentle stroking of the dying's hands gives them reassurance and tells them that you're there and everything's okay. And gentle singing is also something which is extremely good. And I also want to draw out this idea that people who have been unconscious for some time often suddenly wake up and have a lucid interval just before they die. Sometimes they can say something when they greet the visitor, or they can hold out their hands. And because we went to nursing homes, we also found that people who had a long illness with dementia sometimes suddenly became lucid and clear and recognized the family just before they die. So it's a very special time.
In chaplaincy, we call that a ministry of presence.
Lovely. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
You don't have to say a thing. Just being there and having that light touch. First time caller line, Valerie is in Phoenix for Dr. Peter Fenwick. Valerie?
Hello, Ian. Doctor?
Hi, good evening.
My experience is a little bit different than what you're talking about. When my husband died, it was a normal day. He went to work. I was running errands. And in the afternoon, I guess my brain, my head, I just got flooded with thoughts of my husband. And I later found out that it was at the exact time that he had died. But I didn't expect anything to be wrong with him.
Right.
I didn't realize anything was wrong.
Right.
And I was just curious, how come some people, they know right away that something happened, but I didn't know. Until the doctor actually told me that he didn't make it, that he had passed away, I didn't have a clue.
Peter?
I think that this depends. Some people seem to have it much stronger than others. And I think there are all shades of it. And this is why they're called deathbed coincidences, because sometimes one could say, okay, it's just due to coincidence. Many people have thoughts about their husband, but nothing actually happens. But on this time, they did. And I think it's the gradation of it. I think sometimes you do know, sometimes you don't know. And sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between just random thoughts which are going on and the actual deathbed coincidence or deathbed communication. We, in fact, have got a scale which we tried to make up to tell us whether, in fact, the experience that people had was a coincidence or whether it was a deathbed communication. The scale seems to work quite well on our data. One of the important things, points in it, is whether, in fact, these were occurring at the time that somebody was dying or not. So I think the answer really to what you experienced is that for you, the communication didn't get through very strongly, although it was there in sort of rudimentary form.
The book is just great, and I think everybody would enjoy it. It's The Art of Dying. Dr. Peter Fenech comes back for final hour. We'll take more questions and comments for Dr. Fenech, and we haven't forgotten about the animal and sort of the assorted, almost kind of uncategorical experiences that people passed along, which Dr. Fenech discusses in The Art of Dying. And so we'll get to that. And we'll also give you the email address again, and we'll try and put that up on the website, too, so that you can pass along your stories to Dr. Fenech. If you don't get through on the phones next hour, Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. We'll keep going with this great conversation to Richard in Fresno, California, on the wildcard line for Dr. Peter Fenech on Coast to Coast AM. Richard?
Hi, Ian and Dr. Peter Fenech. I want to thank you both for all you do to help people, because these kind of things are things that people really need to know about. It would really help people. But
thank
I
you.
Wanted to tell you about this one particular instance that I had, an experience I had back in the late 70s. I had a dear friend whose first name was Dale. And 3 weeks before this incident, his son had died from hepatitis. And my friend also had hepatitis. And one afternoon, I just had this, I guess you'd call it a psychic experience, that Dale was in the hospital, you know, which is about a couple miles from where I lived. And I could just see a red, you know, all over it, and felt like something was really wrong with him, you know. And I could see this sign overhead that, you know, flashing, you know, about some kind of a danger or something. And I just had this intense desire to, I'm Native American, and I know things about healing and natural herbs and stuff. And so I wanted to take some cayenne over there and try. I had the sense that he was bleeding, and I wanted to go over there and stop the bleeding with cayenne. But I knew that a hospital is not going to let you go in and put cayenne on somebody, so I didn't go. But I found out later that, in fact, he had died after they had attempted to do a biopsy on his liver. And when they cut in, the liver just started bleeding and just would not stop.
They nicked him or something. Yeah, very interesting. Richard, yeah, I think you'd find there are quite a few stories like that in the book, The Art of Dying. Let's go to Mike in Ithaca, New York on Coast to Coast AM. Mike?
Hi there, Ian. Hi, Dr. Fenech. Your screener said I could cover two things if I did the first thing real quick. The first one is that when people are hit by lightning, even though they might be at room temperature or, you know, warmer temperatures, they can last for hours with their vital signs gone and be resuscitated. For some reason, lightning is different than other things, so that, that the brain can stay alive.
I hadn't heard that. That's interesting.
The other thing I wanted to say is that one of these deathbed coincidences, when Richard Nixon was dying, he was telling his daughter he didn't want to be resuscitated, and she was arguing, insisting he get medical help, and he said no, and they had a fight, and she went out in a huff. And then she came back, and he gave her the thumbs-up sign, and she took this as a sign that he was going to be all right and he'd accept medical help, and she left feeling okay. And I was hearing about this on the radio while it was happening, and I felt it was okay, and I felt I could safely take a nap. And after I'd been sleeping for a while, I had a dream that Richard Nixon came to visit me. He was flying like in a small airplane in which he was lying prone in the fuselage, sort of going to heaven. And he said to me from a loudspeaker as he went by, "Now you stay in touch with your cousin. Don't lose touch with your cousin." My cousin had worked for him. And he was a helicopter engineer. And so when I had that dream, I interpreted that as Nixon on his way to heaven. He must have died. And I woke up in a start, turned on the radio, and they announced on the radio that he had died within the last 60 seconds.
That's very interesting. Well, thank you, Mike. But Mike brings up something here, and I hadn't thought about this. What about the stories of what did you hear? What did you get in your research about people whose life passed before their eyes before they died? Did that happen?
Yes, it does. Not quite in the way that you get near-death experiences from people who are drowning, because there it seems all to be very quick. But in people as they approach death, there is a lot of life review going on, and there's very little doubt that people do revisit many of the themes of their childhood and of their life. So a reconsideration of your life is certainly carried out by the dying. And sometimes people seem to have a life review where they have to come to terms with everything which went on. And could I just comment on what Richard said?
Yeah.
He said, "Thanks very much for helping people." And I'd just like to reemphasize that, and that is that dying, as we have been told about it by the dying themselves, isn't that frightening. And people do seem to come to terms with it. And if the accounts of the dying are correct, then we needn't be nearly so frightened. But the other point is that there is this taboo we have in our society of not discussing with each other the wonderful things that happen to us when those close to us do die. So what I'd like to happen is that we get over this taboo and we start discussing it much more amongst ourselves. I think that's very important.
Well, you've helped a lot. So let's go ahead then, too, and take a moment to stress your email address and your willingness to hear from people via the Internet. It's Peter_ and then, as we would pronounce it, Fenwick, but it's Peter_Fenwick @, and then what's the rest of that, Peter?
BTinternet.com.
Okay, and we'll get a link up on the webpage for that to make it easier for people to communicate with you. Zoe is in Vancouver, B.C. Yes, you are.
Yes. Ian and Dr. Fenwick, Dr. Peter, you're so right. My grandmother was a trained nurse, and she would sit with the dying if they had no one with them when the metabolism was low in the early hours of the morning, and they would have this moment of lucidity, she said. They would sometimes come out of a coma, and someone would come to get them most often. So she didn't really have a fear of dying after doing that work. However, she had a fabulous experience, which was actually quite frightening, but it was fabulous. When she had her third baby, she was advanced in age, and all of a sudden she felt her life, her eyes going dark, and she realized she was having a postpartum hemorrhage because she knew what that was. And all of a sudden, she was out of her body and floating up, and she knew what the doctors were doing and saying, and the nurses were all panicking. And she looked to her side, and she saw Jesus. And he didn't say anything. He was dressed in a medieval crown with a beautiful gold cope. And he smiled a dazzling smile to her and motioned with his hand to come to him. And she wasn't particularly religious or anything like that, but she did say to him, I've just had a baby and I have other children. Please, you know, please let me go back. I know you can do that. And he just looked at her in a very loving way, and he nodded. And at that moment, she felt the pain, and she was right back, and they were all shouting, oh, we got her back. So she never told anyone about it. And 10 years later, my mother, who was an older child, had brought a book home from school, and she was flipping through it. And there she found a picture that was exactly what she'd seen, and she asked about this picture. And it was apparently the original is hanging in Oxford, and I think Keble College. And when my mother went to read fine art there, she went to go and visit the picture, and it was exactly what my grandmother described. Mm. Isn't that lovely? And the other thing was that my grandmother's brothers had been in the First World War, and they both told of the Angel of Mons. Have you heard about that, Dr. Peter?
Tell me.
The Battle of Mons stopped abruptly when a huge angel appeared in the sky from one, Ian, you'd like this, but, you know, from one end of the horizon to the other, everything, all hostility stopped, everybody saw it, and it stayed there for the duration of the day until, you know, night, and it was a great comfort to everyone and the dying and all the rest of it. Enormous angel. And it's on somewhere you can look it up, I think. You know, Angel of Mons.
Yeah.
And that was somewhere, in Belgium, Flanders or somewhere.
Yes, that's correct.
And there's one other thing that sort of troubled me, because my grandmother had always, you know, of course she died when she was 96 or something like that, you know, and very peaceful and all the rest. But she did say there were one or two deaths that frightened her somewhat. You know, actually there were two men that she mentioned who didn't want to go, and I read an account of Voltaire's death, and apparently he had cut an artery in his arm in an accident, and at that moment, this is before, about 10 years before, and he cried out, Jesus Christ, I'm sorry, I'll retract what I've written about you, just make this bleeding stop, and it stopped. It just stopped. So he was thrilled, but he didn't get around to retracting anything. And then when he died, he had there were 10 witnesses with him, and the temperature in the room soared, and then it went cold, and it's, you know, they smelled sulfur, and everyone was screaming, and it was just a complete opposite of what one would want. And then he died, and all 10 of those men went back to practicing Christianity after that. So I think they were Catholics, but what do you make of that? I mean, I know there are odd instances, like Rasputin's death was not
right,
peaceful,
right.
Things
well,
like that. What do you make of that, Dr. Peter?
Well, there are really a lot of interesting things you said. First of all, the lucidity before people die. That certainly, we've got lots of accounts of that.
Yes.
The NDE, when she saw Jesus, fits into the prototypical NDE type story.
Yes.
And being allowed to come back is also all part of it.
Yes.
Now, the question of the room temperature and the room changing when Voltaire died, we've got a number of accounts of it becoming very cold in the room at the time of death.
Oh, you know about that.
So that isn't necessarily linked to what the people believe or the sort of death they have. It seems to be much more be actually part of the death process. With some people, those around them sense this drop in temperature at the time of death.
Yes.
But it's really interesting.
Dr. Benedict Groeschel does what you do. I think he's a clinical psychiatrist. He's actually a Capuchin in New York. I don't know if he's still alive, but he wrote about some of these things as well. I don't know whether you have contact with him or not, but very interesting as well. Yes.
After this show, it doesn't matter to me whether he's still alive. We can still contact him. So I'm feeling pretty. But there or not, we'll get him. And thank you, Zoe. Very interesting. Again, The Art of Dying is the name of the book. And she brought up the battlefield experience. And then I guess that brings me back to thinking about some of the assorted things that we didn't get to before. So let's take a minute here, in as much as nobody's brought up a pet story yet, to talk about some of the other types of appearances that you were able to catalog.
We had a number of phenomena, again, at the time of death, which related to animals. We had a number of dog stories. One person reported that when their mother died, they were at home with their dog. And suddenly, at the moment of death, the dog, it was a King Charles Spaniel, I think, howled and howled and howled and howled in the way it had never howled before. We've got one or two experiences like that. We've got another interesting one, that somebody's relative was dying in Japan and they were in Australia. And at the moment of death, their dog looked very, very specifically at what they said to them was, they thought, was probably the apparition of the person who was dying in Japan. So this dog's behaving strangely at the time of death is another point. And the next one are birds. We got a lot of accounts of birds sitting on hospice windows throughout the time that people were dying, and lovely bird stories of how birds would, after the death, would come along and spend time with the people who were grieving for their relative. The relative sometimes interpreted this as the spirit of the person coming back. But at any rate, certainly the bird's behavior was different after the death.
Very
finally, cats. I don't know how many of your listeners will have, or if it was in the American newspapers, heard of Oscar the Cat from a hospice in the USA. And Oscar used to go around, lived in the hospice, and he would go and sit on the beds of the dying about 4 days before they died. And so a visit from Oscar usually meant that that person was going to die. Now, when that came out, we got four English hospices who wrote to us to say they'd noticed exactly the same thing with their cats. So obviously cats have this sort of sense.
Mm. It's just amazing. Barbara is in Washington, D.C. for Dr. Peter Fenech, The Art of Dying. Barbara?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I find it really interesting that every time there's a program similar to this, it just ties in with what I'm going on in my life that I turn it on. About a year ago, both my mom and my brother were diagnosed, my mom terminal, and my brother also. My brother, he quickly went into the hospital for 2 weeks, and then for 2 weeks we put him in the facility, and hospice came in. And he had cirrhosis and other things going on, so he was very jaundiced. And when he passed away, there were four of us around him, and it was really a heart-wrenching and a beautiful experience at the same time. He went through all the steps that you spoke about, how when they pass and their respiration slows down. And because he was very jaundiced, he'd been under medication, he was rarely ever did his eyes open at the last few days. And when he did pass, the four of us were around him. We were stroking him and just talking with him and helping him along. And he suddenly opened his eyes, and he looked up to the top of the room, and his eyes did open wider than they had been in the last month. His eyes, the whites of his eyes were white. They were no longer yellow. His eyes were as blue as you've probably ever seen in any pictures, that beautiful pictures of Christ. And he just looked up, and his eyes were so wide. And then he let go. And I was wondering, with this, I felt like it was like an instant healing that took place before he left, because only two of us noticed that his eyes, the jaundice in his eyes, right, were gone.
Right. Very
and it just it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience, and he did leave. And now we're mom's hung on for all this time. It was a year ago on Halloween.
We're running out of time here. We're running out of time here, Barbara, and I'd really like to get a comment on that part of the story, so I'll just ask you to hang on and ask Dr. Peter, what about that? Do you have any other stories?
That is just a wonderful story. And we got a number of accounts of this. This is a complete transformation which occurs actually at the time of death. And I very much liked the idea that his eyes were bluer than they'd ever been. And
right,
this question of blueness does seem to come up.
And
In other words, the eyes do shine more brightly and people are transformed.
And just at that moment of death, he was well again for just the last few seconds.
And that is reported
over and over. The Art of Dying, Dr. Peter Fenech, who is a neuropsychiatrist, a scientist, and also somebody with an open mind looking at these unexplained phenomena, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Back to Dr. Peter Fenech, neuropsychiatrist and author of the book The Art of Dying, and explaining his expertise. It would probably take too long here with all of the calls, but suffice it to say, very well qualified to talk about various near-death phenomena. And John is in New York on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Peter Fenech. John?
Hello, Ian. Hello, Peter. How are you?
Hi. Good evening.
I got a question and a little comment here. The first thing, we'll reverse that here. Now, did you ever see the Twilight Zone episode when the clock actually died out and the old man died?
No, I never saw that, but go on.
Okay. My comment is, now, everything is in speculation. Now, when you have the way you're practicing and what you're doing exactly, everything, you can have the Pope, you can have Harold Camping, you can have anybody in the world, but it is all speculation. So people got to understand that. I'm not trying to insult your intelligence.
I don't understand what you're saying there. I think you may have missed some of the show then, John. We did talk about the clocks earlier, and there is a whole chapter in the book. But when you say speculation, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is when he's saying it could be anything from sleep deprivation, it could be anything. But he just puts certain things in a class that it's all speculation. When you die, this happens. It could be a lack of oxygen when, you know, people see things
well,
at the right time.
Well, let's ask a better question. Let's actually ask that. And Dr. Fenech, could it just be lack of oxygen? Could it just be, you know, somebody sitting on the bed funny? I mean, what can we know about the science of this?
Okay. I like John's question very much because as a scientist, one looks at all a full range of explanations. And it depends really what we are going to talk about. Let's talk about, first of all, science and how you get data. The first stage of science is that you collect reports of a phenomenon. Then the next stage is you set out to see if you can collect these reports reliably. Then the third stage is that you make hypotheses from it. Now, what we're doing at the moment is we're collecting data. In other words, we're seeing what's out there. And what is out there is the phenomena. Let's say clock stopping or deathbed visions. So people tell us stories. Now, when we did our study, we did it in two bits. We talked to carers of the dying and said, tell us the stories that you've had told to you in the last 5 years. And so we got a lot of stories in. And then we said to the carers, we're going to come back in a year and tell us all the things that you've seen in the last year and heard repeated to you. So we then went back a year later, and this is called a prospective study, and we looked at what had actually happened during that year. And so that tightens up the data a bit. Now, the next step, and this is John's point, I think, is that supposing somebody is seeing a deathbed vision, could it be due to confusion? Could it be due to the fact that because they're dying, their blood chemistry is upset? Could it be because they're not breathing properly, they're anoxic? All these sorts of questions now come into focus. As far as the data that we've had at the moment, these sets of explanations have mainly been discounted by the carers of the dying at the time. One of the reasons for that is that in deathbed visions, the people are extremely clear, they're lucid, and that doesn't go with the confusional state that John is suggesting, but it's one of the possibilities, but it doesn't seem to be the correct one at the moment. Now let's go to clock stopping. Do clocks stop? Well, you do exactly the same thing. You do a retrospective study, and you get your stories, and then you take a number of deaths, and you say how many of these people had their clocks stop, and then you actually set it up. And you can set it up with clocks in the room and things like that and see if the clocks stop when you're actually observing them. So there are levels of proof and levels of collecting data. At the moment, we're between the first and the second, and the third's yet to come.
Vicki is in Kentucky on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Peter Fenwick. Vicki?
Hi, Peter and Ian.
Hi, Vicki.
I'm a little nervous here. I took care of my uncle. He was 82 years old. He wasn't on any kind of medicine or anything. And he went through a lot of different phases before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw all his sisters and brothers and his mother and father, which are my great-grandparents and my grandparents. And there was one time, well, a few, about the same time, what I'm going to tell you, he was acting like half his age, like he was 40 years old. Have you ever heard of that, acting half your age?
The age changes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's what you were saying.
Yes. I have heard of that. And we have a number of accounts where the people, when they come back, this is in the deathbed visions, appear younger than they did at the time of their death. And this is something which is very common also in near-death experiences. And it does seem that there is a sort of healing which goes on of the people who have died in the visions of them that people have. So, yes, it is reported.
That it's an intriguing thought that you're probably feeling your oldest and your most frail. And then somewhere in the process of reconciling yourself to death, it's like the clock has turned back and you can spend your last few hours feeling like a much younger person again.
Yes.
Love that. Maria is in Sunnyvale, California on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Peter Fenwick. Maria?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
When my stepdad died, me and my daughters had driven up 3 hours to go see him the morning that he did pass away. And we had spent the morning with him and left about noontime, and he was still alive. And on the way home, the 3 hours home, we stopped at a restaurant to have lunch. And it took forever and ever and ever to have lunch for it to get delivered. And I kept looking into the kitchen, and I kept looking and looking. You know, where's our waitress? Where's our food? Now all of this. Well, finally it got there. We ate. And then, you know, I said, man, we've been here over an hour. You know, we got to get back on the road. And but we didn't have a watch on. And you know, and all of a sudden I looked at the door that I had been looking at. And there was a clock right above it. And I had never seen that clock. And it said 2:03. So then and I looked at my girls and I go, look, there's a clock. I said, it's 2:03. I said, we got to get going. So then finally the waitress came, we paid, we get in the car. My mother calls and she goes, he just passed away. I go, Mom, what time? And she goes, 2:03.
Gosh. Yeah.
And, you know, it just, you know, I go, I can't believe that's when I saw this clock. I said, I've been here over an hour in this restaurant and looking at that door that whole time for the food, for the waitress and everything. I said, I did not see that clock.
That's amazing.
And then I saw the clock, and it said 2:03, and she called.
I think that's really interesting. And it reminds me also of what happened in Japan. There was a man who worked for the Ministry of Defense, and he collected stories from the widows of people who were killed on the battlefield. And he reported that the widows sometimes experienced in some way what was going on the battlefield with their husbands when they died. And it looks as if in some way your mother was linked with you at the time of her death. And so you looked at the clock and it was 2:03.
This reminds me actually of a guest we had a couple of months ago who has written about the extraordinary experiences, the supernatural experiences of extreme athletes, and how under certain circumstances they have had visitations. And one of these was a story about some people who had been visited by somebody who was climbing Mount Everest. And I'd really love to hook you up with her if you'd like to talk to her. She's written almost a whole book about these supernatural experiences, and including the prolonged visitation that she got regularly from somebody that she had been involved with, who died on Everest, and the visitations didn't stop until she made the effort to climb up there and sort of reconcile herself with his death. And I'd love to shoot her email address, because I think you'd find that fascinating, Dr. Fennick.
It'd be absolutely fascinating. Yes, I'd like that very much.
Several great books. Larry is in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Peter Fennick. Larry?
Good evening, gentlemen. In all the years that they've talked about NDEs on Coast to Coast, I've never heard this question asked. What happens when several people die together in a plane, a bus, train?
Oh, great.
Do they see each other on the other side? Do they communicate with each other? Do they flip a coin to see who's going to come back? Has there ever been reports where people have reported seeing the people that they died with, or are they all in some individual space and time?
A mass NDE, as it were.
That's a really interesting question. I've studied a lot of NDEs, and I know of only one such experience, and this was told by a person who was dying in an intensive care unit. I think it was after an accident. There were two or three of them in the intensive care unit. And in his NDE, this man saw himself. Actually, they were flying through the air towards the light. And he recognized that beside him was flying one of the other people in the next door bed, and they were flying towards the light. And at some point, as they were getting close to the light, the guy who's telling the story said that he had to come back, and the other guy flew on and disappeared into the light, and he came back. And, of course, when he regained consciousness, he found the other guy had died. But that's the only story I know of a sort of common shared NDE.
And that reminds me of some we've had on a couple of times in the show, a woman named Dr. Janice Amatuzio, and she is a coroner here in Minnesota, where I live, and she had cataloged a couple of these occurrences where somebody was having a near-death experience, left the room, saw things they could not have possibly have seen, heard things that were happening while their body was, medically speaking, dead on the table. Heart stopped, brain activity stopped, and yet they were able to remember things that had happened, so that when they came back, they told the doctors all, they sort of filled in the narrative of what had happened while their heart had stopped. Do you run into that too frequently?
Well, what we're doing is we're doing a prospective cardiac arrest study, and this is being driven by Dr. Sam Parnia, who's working in New York at the moment. And in the UK, he's got 20 hospitals with boards up in their intensive care departments. And the aim of that is to see if people, when they've had a cardiac arrest, no pulse, no respiration, no brainstem reflexes, whether they report that they have left their bodies and watched the resuscitation process, and whether they then go on to have an NDE. Now, in that, they can gain information apparently when their brain isn't functioning, certainly about the arrest. And some of them, of course, report also that they see things in other rooms. So we're doing that in a prospective way and see whether or not we get good data from it.
Connie is in Nevada, a first-time caller line for Dr. Peter Fenech on Coast to Coast AM. Connie?
Yes, Ian and Dr. Fenech. It's very, very interesting. I had an experience with my mother just prior to her death. She had seen her father before she passed away, and then she had a fall, and we had to move her. And I was looking for a place to relocate her, and I came up to a road that I had to turn either left or right. And I kept in my brain getting a message, you have to go straight. And I looked at the road, and I went, I can't go straight. I have to go left or right. And I got that message again. I pulled into what was straight ahead. It was a parking lot of a hospital. I went in, looked around to try and figure out why I was supposed to be there, ran into a Catholic priest, talked to him, and told him I was looking for a place for my mother, and he helped me find a place. And long story short, a year later, my mother had a heart attack and ended up in that hospital. She had Alzheimer's, couldn't recognize anyone. I came to her bedside, and she recognized me, talked to me, where she hadn't been able to do that. And her doctor said she was going to be going home. And I sat with her and talked to her, and I said, Mom, you know, I'm going to be okay, and the family's okay if you want to go home with Dad. And my father had already passed away. You know, go ahead. And she talked to me a little bit more, and she then, her body started to let go, and the priest that helped me find a place for her came in and was with both of us until she died. And
very interesting full circle then, isn't it?
From very interesting.
From go straight.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you, Connie. Well, in the time that we have, and we just have a minute or so left, do we want to take another second to talk about what your hope is for this book? And then we'll make sure people have your email address, too.
My hope for this book is that it will be widely read. The publishers have kept the price down so that it should be available to everyone. And it gives a much clearer picture of what death and dying is like. One doesn't have to be afraid of it. And I think the important thing is that we know about it, and not only that we know about the book, but we know about death, and we start talking about it, because death is part of life. And coming to terms with death, planning what we want to do, how we're going to have a good death, where we want to die, is very, very important. So I think that knowledge is the most powerful way that we can, in fact, prepare ourselves for death.
Well, this discussion of death made for a very lively show, and yet not everybody was able to get through. So the email address again is Peter_ what we would say Fenwick, but it's pronounced Fenech. Peter_Fenech at Peter?
BTInternet.com. BT is Bravo Tango. BTInternet.com, all one word.
I know you'll be hearing a few more. And I'd love this conversation to continue again sometime. So let's just adjourn for now and convene sometime later on while your research continues and you get those emails in. Sound good?
Thank you, Ian. That was wonderful.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for trying to get through. It's make it a beautiful week until we talk again next Saturday. Deus te amat, and I do too.